Welcome to a special broadcast celebrating the opening of the Eugene Symphony's 51st season here on KLCC 89.7 NPR for Oregonians. I'm Eric Allen, KLCC Music Arts and Culture host, and here in the Selco Performance Hall of the KLCC studios with me is Scott Freck, Executive Director of the Eugene Symphony. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much, Eric.
And the symphony opens its season this Thursday evening, September 22nd, with a program that includes music from Webern, Schumann, and Brahms. And tonight we will celebrate with an hour's live broadcast and performance that includes Joshua Roman giving us some cello concerto samples from Schumann and some other pieces as well, the debut of the Symphony Connect String Quartet, and thoughts on the upcoming season from music director and conductor Donny Ilarachev. Well, this is a pivotal year for Eugene Symphony, Scott. After last year's 50th anniversary celebration, the theme of this year is listed as departure and discovery. So how are those two thematic aspects represented?
Well, you know, Eric, last year, if I can go back quickly to that, the 50th anniversary was such a great year for all of us. We really celebrated our past with returns from three former music directors, and we took a deep look at our history and how this orchestra grew into what we know and love today. We also prepared for our future last year with three commissioned works and some innovative community-based programming like our SymFest concert last April, which was really, really fun. In all, we had a fantastic year and are excited to turn the page and get going on this 51st season. So like you said, we've been thinking about this as a year of departure and discovery. So for the departure part, it's a little bit sad, as most departures are. This will be the eighth and final year for our music director, Donny Ilarachev, and he's really saved some personal favorites, some music he's been just cherishing to close out his tenure. And as you mentioned, we're going to hear from him a little bit later in the show to hear what he's looking forward to. Now, this discovery part refers to our music director search as we look for Donny Ilarachev's successor. A few weeks ago, as you know, we named our three finalists after a six-month international process. And I'm going to tell you the numbers. We had more than 250 applications from 44 different countries around the world. And now we're eagerly awaiting the arrival of the three finalists. First is French-Canadian conductor Dina Gilbert in December, and then two American conductors, Ryan McAdams in January and Francesco Lecce-Chong in March. Now, it's going to be a difficult decision, I'm sure, but it's also going to be a really fun ride. And, of course, we open our season this Thursday, September 22nd, at the Holt Center.
I want to ask you just for a moment about the process of finding the conductor, because this symphony has excelled at that, and there seems to be even a process that's getting known in the symphony world nationwide, the Eugene process. Mm. What is it about this symphony and this process that makes it such a great place for conductors?
Well, I have to give credit to the architect of that process, a brilliant man named Roger Sadak. He is an attorney and a deep music lover and has led the search. He's been the chair of, this was his fifth time. That has to be a world record somewhere. He's led it since 1989 when Marin Alsop was hired. And it's a very exhaustive, thoughtful, and very inclusive process. The musicians have equal representation with the community and the board. It's a really great system that's been built here.
It's going to be interesting to have the Symphony Connect program launched this year as well, and we'll speak more about that when we bring the Symphony Connect String Quartet in at the top of the hour. For the moment, we have an opening concert to celebrate this Thursday evening, and we want to welcome into our studios Joshua Roman, a cellist of great renown who is started playing extremely young in Oklahoma and has come to be a Eugene favorite over the years. And he's known not only as a player, but as a composer and a curator as well. Thank you for returning again and to being in our studios here, Joshua.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
Anything, Scott, you'd like to add to his resume? You know this man well.
He's brilliant. I mean, let's ask him.
You're going to have to live up to that now, Joshua.
Oh, my gosh. Anything I'm going to add is going to make it look bad.
Well, I think you might have to be brilliant to represent solo Schumann's cello concerto, because we seem to have neglected to bring an orchestra with us this evening.
So. Yes. Well, and it is, despite its magnificence, I would say it's one of the trickier of the cello concertos. You've got the Dvorak is probably the most famous of the cello concerti, and in that one, it's set up so well for the soloist and the orchestra that you could have your worst night ever, and the piece will still be successful. But there's something about the Schumann that demands this extra bit of attention, and something in the form and the way that it works. and you really have to nail it. And when you do, there's nothing like it. It's so sublime. It's got great moments of intimacy, but it does require some special tender love and care.
It does seem like it has different technical demands than some of the other cello concerti that were perhaps written for more virtuosic things. Why is it so different?
You know, it's hard to say. I think there a lot of people would read into Schumann's mental problems, and a lot's been written about that. And you could say that that is reflected in the piece, this sort of duality between the intensely lyrical and intimate and then also these sort of explosive moments and the technical side that comes through. And he tries to marry these in various ways. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you're in the right frame of mind and you're doing that, then it really works. It's a good setup. But if you're not really keyed in to those special moments where something gets passed from a wind player to the cellist and then back to a different wind player, if you're not really locked in, then it doesn't have the same effect.
Well, you care to dive into a little excerpt of it for us here?
Sure. Yeah. I'll start with the second movement because for me, that's the heart of this piece. And I'll get to the other movements a little bit as well. But in Schumann's life, I think the most dominant figure and the most sort of influential person in his life was his wife, Clara Schumann, who was a fantastic pianist and was someone that everyone admired. In fact, as much as Schumann was in love with her, I think people talk just as much about how much Johannes Brahms was in love with Clara Schumann. This woman could get the composers going. It was something else. So Robert had, for his wife, he had this beautiful thing, this little motif that he came up with, and just a falling figure that he put in a lot of his music, I believe, but is very pronounced in the second movement. And there's a beautiful duo with the principal cellist that I get to do. And you hear throughout this sort of falling motif, which is supposed to be representative of him sort of sighing with intense love and affection, Clara. And it sort of falls down, and it's like this. So throughout the second movement, you have this falling figure. And I'll play for you now just the opening theme. And as you hear it, you'll hear all sorts of different variations of this appoggiatura figure and these falling fifths and fourths and just thinking of just how much this man loved his wife. Second movement, which ends up being quite a short movement, but has in its simplicity has a lot of depth and really does become the heart of the piece. And you find that I feel like that figure is turned, the idea of this sort of rising and falling is used throughout the piece. I'm going to play for you now the opening of the first movement. And this is one of the more famous melodies in the cello and orchestra literature. And this one for a very different reason. This is where Schumann shows his ability to take a line and keep spinning it out. This melody just keeps going and you turn all of these corners. There are little flourishes that change the character of it and big leaps and falls. And it really just, it's one long phrase. It's not really broken up and it's something quite remarkable. So here's the opening of the exposition from the Schumann Cello Concerto. Thank you. So that's how it opens, which is quite you can't say meandering at all. I mean, he really has a direction, but he's really allowing the phrase to unfold and to really go somewhere. And the level of intensity just is constantly in flux. And I think it's one of the very special things about Schumann's writing and one of the things that carries the concerto through.
This a concerto was one that really wasn't appreciated in his lifetime. It wasn't even performed in his lifetime. When there's such beauty in it from a historical perspective now, why do you think there was such resistance to it when it was first written?
You know, that might have to do with the technical demands. Yeah. I don't know. There's always that, you know, and to this day, when one of my friends will send me a cello concerto, I will send it back. I'll say, this is too hard. that's not really true. Often I do spend the time necessary to figure out if it's possible, but what we think is possible changes from decade to decade and certainly from century to century. Should we do some of the third movement?
Why don't we just set a tiny little bit of the third movement just so we know where it's at, but not too much. Don't want to give too many secrets.
So that's the thing, and you'll hear, I'll give just a brief example. This is where the Schumann concerto, it becomes a tricky piece because it relies on the passing back and forth, the chamber music aspect of working with the individuals and the orchestra. So even the opening of this third movement, I'm going to have to hum a little bit because the melody is kind of hocketed, which means it's broken up between various parts. So the orchestra gets part of it and I get part of it. Neither of us gets the whole thing. So it goes something like this.
Dum, bum, 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 da, ya, da, da.
So it's back and forth like that the whole time. You never get to listen to one person for very long. And it all makes total sense melodically and harmonically, but that's where I'm very excited that I get to work with an orchestra like Eugene, and we get to dive in, and I think Daniel has a really good grasp on it. So we're going to have a lot of fun working out how we pass these things around and bring you along on this journey as if it's of one mind.
And yet it has individual mind in it too, because every player brings a certain heart and soul into it. So
absolutely.
Is there something in particular that you want to bring out of that piece?
Well, for me, it is... in a way, it's this joy of the third movement. I mean, the first movement has its own sort of sentimental, almost melancholic feel, and then you've got the pining for his wife in the second movement. They're very obvious. And then I think in the last movement, it's a funny kind of joy because it's not unbridled. It's not the sort of Beethovenian joy. Beethoven would just cut loose and say, "Let's just be all out happy. Let's just go for it." Schumann is. He's being joyful, but there's a little twist, and I think that twist is very interesting. So bringing that out is, I think, the goal.
Well, nice job with the humming, by the way. Although I personally am looking forward to hearing you put it together with the orchestra.
Yeah, they'll be louder than my humming. It'll be good.
You know, I was going to ask you, Josh, this concerto is a little bit of an outlier. There really aren't that many solo concertos for this obviously very lyrical and very powerful instrument, at least not before 1900 or so. So you think Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, none of them ever wrote a solo cello concerto. Now it seems like there's so many more choices, especially beginning the 20th century. You think Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Britten, Barber that you just played last week.
Right.
Tons of living composers today writing for this instrument. What changed? Why is this different now?
Well, I think you can see this with each instrument that it's a sort of ecosystem between the composer, the audience, and the players. So what you have is you have a great player might inspire a composer to write a piece that meets the technical that matches their technical level. And then you have an audience that might hear a piece or might hear a performer, and then people will be inspired to go learn to play the cello because they heard something they didn't realize was possible. But you know, that's each of those things has to be there to create a repertoire and to create a culture of progress, technical progress on an instrument, which is fundamental to having good music. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can only play one note, you're pretty limited. So
that describes me.
Well, there are times when I like to play one note also. But it's very these things are very codependent. And so someone like Pablo Casals comes along and changes the game for cellists in terms of technique. And all of a sudden, composers are inspired because there's a whole crop, not just this fearless leader, but a whole crop of cellists. Rostropovich in the 20th century was another great figure who not only inspired people to write music, but made it a point to go out and commission as much new music as possible. So once you get to the 20th century, the cellists are almost, you could make an argument for cellists having caught up at some point in the 20th century with two Shostakovich concertos by Penderecki, Ludoslavsky, Ligeti, you name a famous composer in the 20th century, and they wrote a cello concerto. And that was not true, as you said, that was not true in the 18th and 19th centuries. Although last time I was here, I did get to play the Beethoven triple, which the cello part in that, oh my gosh, that is so great. It is like a cello concerto.
Right. It's with those annoying piano and violin in the way, too.
Yeah, they help. They help. It's nice. Right. It's nice to share. But yeah, I think another thing that people don't realize is that Bach, I mean, for me at least, I always grew up thinking of Bach as being the seminal composer for the cello. You think of the six suites and you think of this is the acme. This is the test of a cellist. The cellists make a recording or two or three over the course of their careers. And what a lot of people don't realize is that this wasn't premiered until the early 1900s. Pablo Casals, again, with Pablo Casals, he really influenced heavily. He basically discovered and gave the world premiere of the six solo suites for cello by Johann Sebastian Bach. He was walking down a street in Barcelona with his father, and he saw in a shop window, I think it was the edition that he saw called them etudes, but six sonatas or six etudes for solo cello, and he was shocked. And so they ran in there and they bought it. They'd never heard of something like this, and people didn't really perform it. Even Bach was basically forgotten as his sons became famous until Felix Mendelssohn discovered his work and created basically a Bach revival. But the cello suites took a lot longer than that. And so Pablo Casals, the legend has it that when he discovered them in the late 1800s, he practiced every day for 12 years before giving the world premiere of the six Bach suites for the solo cello. So after that, again, because of that, people were super inspired. Cellists wanted to learn that music. Composers started writing solo cello music, which really did not exist in the 19th century. And now we have a beautiful repertoire and are building a tradition from this great music, which, you know, maybe we should.
Should we hear some?
Yeah.
Joshua Roman, live in the KLCC studios. He'll be live with the Eugene Symphony at the Holt Center in Eugene this Thursday evening, September 22nd, in a program that includes Webern's Passacaglia, Brahms' Final Symphony No. 4, and the Schumann Cello Concerto. You were talking about Bach. Is that what's next on your evening?
Yeah, let's do some Bach. I always love to play Bach, and there's one that is very obviously recognizable, but for me, there's good reason for that. I love playing this. It was the first one that I learned, and I'm always happy to share where it is with me, whatever day it is. So we'll turn now to Bach, who gave us, I think, some of our greatest works for solo cello, and this is the prelude from the first suite. Thank you.
Nice.
That was beautiful. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you.
Well, you know, there's the composer, there's the player, and there's the instrument. And here you are with this beautiful, slightly small, and somewhat vintage instrument you brought with us. Tell us about this instrument you have.
Well, this is an instrument from 1899. It was made in Venice by Giulio Degani, the son of Eugenio, who was also a violin maker. And it does have narrow ribs. If you look at it from the side, then you might think that the profile is more like that of a violin. Obviously a big violin. Wouldn't want to try to hold this under your neck. But the dimensions are closer to that. The ratios are closer to that of a violin in some ways. But it is also very tall, like its player. So it's a very tall instrument and actually doesn't quite even fit in the case. So it makes up for its skinniness.
Got to push really hard, you know. It'll go.
Oh, it goes in. Barely.
So do you want to do a little bit more Bach? Would be great.
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
I think, well, now let's turn to something contemplative. I love, this is one of my favorite movements. I'm playing all my favorite movements. I'm so selfish. But these are what I think are the best. This is the Sarabande, also from the first suite. And something that I've always loved, I was reading about the Sarabande, which, by the way, if you have a chance to YouTube video someone dancing the Sarabande, it will surprise you. It looks very different than you would guess hearing this. By the time Bach wrote this, people didn't really dance it so much anymore, so he changed some of the character of it. But there's this reaching. It's in three, like a waltz or many other dance forms. But in this one, it's a slow three, and the emphasis is on the second beat. So it's one, two, three. And what that does is it gives it a sense of reaching forward, of reaching higher. And I read something that was written over, you know, centuries ago that was talking about the nobility in a Sarabande and about this aspirational reaching forward. So that's what I love to think of, as well as the tenderness in here, is the aspiration to nobility.
Thank you.
Joshua Roman, Tenderness and Aspirations of Nobility, right?
Yes.
That's beautiful. That matches that music perfectly. Very well spoken, and thank you for performing that.
Of course.
We have just a few minutes left in this half hour, and we've talked a lot about the contrast between the initial and older repertoire and the newer repertoire for the cello these days. Do you want to close with a modern piece?
I'd love to. Yeah, this I have one that I love to play. It's sort of a jam piece in a way. I don't know if you know the Turtle Island String Quartet.
I do indeed.
Yeah, they do. If you haven't heard of them, the Turtle Island String Quartet. Do they do any classical music?
It depends how you define classical, and it's okay. Evolved with the players over the years.
That's a good question. Yes, how do you define classical? Well, you're unlikely to see a program of all Beethoven string quartets. More likely, you'll see a collaboration with a jazz artist or a pop artist or bluegrass style music, and all of those influences come into play in this piece. Their cellist, Mark Sommer, back in the 80s would do this improv, and you know, I had this nice little theme that he'd come up with, and eventually people said, you got to write it down. And so he did. He eventually agreed, and I got the music. It's called Julie O, and what's really fun is that in the liner notes to the music, the sheet music, he says, do not do this the way that I wrote it. I'm paraphrasing heavily, but he encourages the cellist to improvise. There's one spot in particular that's marked with an asterisk that you have to make up your own thing. So it's a lot of fun, and you'll hear a lot of influences from modern day culture and in the grand tradition of Bach and Schumann and all of the composers that we know from before the 20th century. This is someone who knows how to improvise and is a performer composer, just like all of our lauded masters. So here's Julio by Mark Sommer. Thank you.
That was Joshua Roman with a piece from Mark Summer and the Turtle Island String Quartet live in the Selco Performance Hall of the KLCC Studios. He'll be performing with the Eugene Symphony in their season opening concert this Thursday evening, September 22nd, at the Holt Center in Eugene, performing Schumann's Cello Concerto in A minor in entirety with the symphony. Also on the program that evening, Brahms' Symphony No. 4 and Webern's Passacaglia. Joshua, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to a special broadcast celebrating the opening of Eugene Symphony's 51st season here on KLCC NPR for Oregonians at 89.7, KLCC Eugene, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFO Florence 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, and KLBR Bend. Also streaming live on KLCC.org, KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. I'm Eric Allen with Scott Freck here, and for the second part of our live performance tonight, we'll be exploring the Symphony's new Symphony Connect program, a chamber music initiative reaching out into the community. Before we do, however, we want to take a few minutes to speak with outgoing conductor and music director Donna Ilarachev about his final season at the helm, beginning with his thoughts on Brahms No. 4. One highlight of this season's opening concert is Brahms Symphony No. 4, his last symphony, which I know is a personal favorite of yours. Why does that piece inspire such passion for you?
Well, Brahms in general inspires a great passion in me. Every piece by him that I conduct feels like one of the most important things of any season or any moment of the year. But of course, it's significant to do the fourth symphony, which maybe emotional impact is so incredibly powerful, and is the last thing that Brahms says as a symphonist.
What inspired you to unite the Brahms and the Webern with the Schumann Cello Concerto?
In more than one way, Schumann is connected with Brahms. And also playing with Josh is always fun. It's going to be my third time performing with him. And I've never heard him do Schumann, so I'm very excited to hear what he will do with this piece. But the piece is kind of lighter, not as dramatic or heavy as Brahms's. And yet it has a similar kind of Germanic idea, personality.
And then in the next concert in October, you'll conduct Mahler's Sixth Symphony, considered a tragic piece and yet apparently written during one of his happiest periods of life. Do you feel the happiness and the beauty as well as the tragedy in that piece?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things that were happening in his life that were happy, but also certain things that were not happy at all. You could feel different influences in this piece, but overwhelmingly the piece is tragic. And it has this last movement that's probably the grandest last movement of any symphony of Mahler. And it is really enormously glorious and special, you know, almost like cathedral of sounds, this last movement. Also, I'm excited that I can give this kind of challenge to the Eugene Symphony, which hasn't played this kind of piece in a long time.
One of the most unusual aspects of the upcoming season will be your collaboration with Harmonic Laboratory, this valley's multimedia collective, which will integrate digital projections with The Damnation of Faust by Berlioz. Why does the Berlioz piece lend itself to that kind of experimentation?
When he conceived the piece, he thought of it as a piece that probably will be staged. It's important for the audience to see how a dramatic piece of music like this unfolds and have an additional connection to the music through this visual part of it, which actually, by the way, is not only going to be video, but could be also dancing. They're very vivid things that one imagines when they listen to this piece, read the text. This piece is just has such an abundance of possibilities for staging, just dramatic possibilities.
And finally, at the close of the season, you'll take on the Alpine Symphony by Richard Strauss. What connection do you feel between that piece and the spirit of Eugene and the Willamette Valley?
That's like the ultimate Eugenian piece, isn't it? what is it closer to a Eugenian than going out in the mountains, climbing some beautiful landscape in the mountains, and then there's the rain coming, and then you got to hide. And that's what happened to Strauss, as you know. That's the story behind it. It is a nice way to finish my time here with a piece that's a grand piece. It's an incredible piece of music.
What kind of emotions do you feel about Eugene and this symphony as you head into your final season?
Once you become a music director somewhere, it's almost like everybody becomes your family, and you feel personally responsible for absolutely everything that happens with that orchestra. This orchestra will be always very close to my heart, and I will have only great memories, and every concert that we've done has been important for me, and so will be the last season the same way.
Thank you for everything you've brought to the symphony in these recent years.
My pleasure, Eric. Always nice to talk to you.
Daniil Ratchev joining me from WHYY in Philadelphia last week. Scott Freck is here with me in the KLCC studios, and one of the new things for the symphony this year is the Symphony Connect program, reaching out in different ways. Tell us what that is, Scott.
Well, you know, Eric, every year about 25,000 people come to our concerts with the full orchestra at the Holt Center and other venues like the Cuthbert and down in Roseburg. But these days, around another 21,000 children and adults participate in our education and community engagement programs. So this year, we're really proud to launch a brand new one called Symphony Connect, as you mentioned. And that's going to put small groups of musicians into non-traditional venues such as restaurants and community hubs, and especially human service agencies. So the idea here is we're going to use music to augment the work that these agencies do for their clients. So in this first year, we're working with four partners. That's the Laurel Hill Center, the Cornerstone Community Housing, St. Vincent de Paul, and Riverfront School. And so together with these partners, we're going to offer interactive chamber music performances to these members of our community who probably wouldn't be able to have experiences like this otherwise. And hopefully this will sort of open the door for them to see how inspiring and even life-changing music can be for them. So with us tonight is a string quartet made up of Eugene Symphony musicians. And in a few weeks, they're going to start presenting these interactive performances, and we're just excited to see where it's going to lead.
The string quartet we have in the studios with this evening includes Lisa McWhorter, also the assistant concertmaster for the Eugene Symphony on violin, also Stephen Chong on violin, Lauren Ellich on viola, and Dale Bradley on cello. Welcome and thank you for being here. Nice to have you here in the studios. So I think we'll dive into a little bit of Haydn to begin. Is that correct? Thank you.
So that's the first movement from Joseph Haydn's string quartet in B-flat major, Opus 76, number 4, which is often called the Sunrise Quartet. It's called that because of the beautiful theme that Lisa McWhorter played at the beginning. It just sounds like the sun coming over the horizon, and then sort of day breaks, and we're off to the races. So the next piece we're going to hear is by our own cellist, Dale Bradley, who's also a composer and arranger, in addition to being a fantastic cellist. Dale, if you could tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear, that'd be great.
Yes, this piece is called Generations. I wrote it, or I guess you could say, or the tune sort of floated in my head as I was reading a book. I bought this book at a garage sale. It's by a registered guard columnist, Bob Welch. It's called A Father for All Seasons. And I was reading about a portion in there where he's describing about his family for many generations having gone up into the Cascade South Sister Wilderness area, and kind of a tradition for many, many years. And as I was reading this passage of the book, these melodies started coming in my head, and I luckily I wrote them down. And that was basically what became this piece, Generations.
Fantastic. Let's hear it. Thank you.
cellist. I'm speechless. Thank you, Dale. That was gorgeous. The Symphony Connect String Quartet live in the KLCC studios. And I believe there's a music therapy connection to this program. Is there not?
That's right, Eric. So to create this new program, Symphony Connect, the Eugene Symphony has been working with a woman named Danielle Orr and her company called Refuge Music Therapy. And of course, our musicians are wonderfully trained musically, but we wanted to make sure that they had the knowledge, really the tools they needed to work successfully with the clients of our partner organizations like Laurel Hill Center and Cornerstone Community Housing. So the quartet has been working with Danielle to choose repertoire and really develop the messaging, really connect the dots, if you will, between the music they're going to play and the people who are going to hear it. So that's how we've been going about this.
And how does that connect to Dvorak, if it does?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe we should just hear Dvorak and find out.
Sounds good to me.
Tantalizing little taste of Dvorak's famous American String Quartet number 12, played by the Eugene Symphony's Symphony Connect group. So I'd like to bring our violist, Lauren Elledge, into this. So talk to us a little bit about what you think hearing a piece like that might do for people, and especially the next piece you're going to play, the Nocturne from Alexander Borodin's String Quartet number 2. What do you think that's going to do for the people who are going to hear it? How might they benefit from this hearing this?
Well, you know, music can do a lot of different things. We all experience it in different ways when we're listening. Sometimes you might see images. You might experience different emotions. I think that the Dvorak we just played definitely is very lively. Personally, I picture a train. But then the Nocturne that we're about to play, another thing that music can do is kind of take up all of your brain space so you're not thinking about the stressful things that maybe you were before. You're just listening to the music, and that's okay too.
Sort of center us and maybe help us regulate and get rid of some of the toxic stress that we can carry around in life.
Yes, absolutely. And this one has a nice steady pulse and a beautiful, beautiful melody. And it also has some scales in there that maybe take you to a different place.
So, So Alexander Borodin, the Nocturne from String Quartet number 2 in D major.
Thank you.
Well, that certainly created some wellness in me. Thank you. That was beautiful. I can't imagine life without music. Can you?
No, no way.
It is so ingrained in wellness of body and mind and spirit. And thank you for bringing that nocturne to us here in the KLCC studios. We're going to be closing this evening with a piece of a classic tone poem from the 1920s, Gershwin's An American in Paris. What do you want to say about this, Scott?
Well, before we get to that, I just want to make one final point, if I could. And the Eugene Symphony's mission is enriching lives through the power of music. And we want to make sure, especially with a program like this, that that doesn't only mean the lives of people who can get to the Holt Center and afford to buy a ticket when they're there. We think that music can have a positive impact on anyone's life and can give them inspiration and hope for a better future. So I can't think of a better way to close our evening than to hear some of the classic sounds by George Gershwin. And this is in a string quartet arrangement by Tony Esposito. So thanks again to our Symphony Connect string quartet, Lisa McWhorter and Stephen Chong and Lauren Elledge and Dale Bradley.
Thank you.
The classic blues theme from Gershwin's An American in Paris, performed live in the KLCC studios by the Eugene Symphony's Symphony Connect String Quartet. Lauren Ellich, Dale Bradley, Stephen Chong, Lisa McWhorter, thank you so much for performing for us tonight.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you, Scott Freck, Executive Director of the Eugene Symphony. Thanks for being co-host here tonight.
Thanks so much, Eric. It was great.
I'm Eric Allen. That does conclude our special broadcast launching the 2016-2017 season of the Eugene Symphony, their 51st season. Their season opens this Thursday, September 22nd, and runs through May 11th. For more information, eugenesymphony.org. Thanks also this evening to Denny Kahn on sound and Don Hine on executive production, Cheryl Crumbly at KLCC for hospitality, Lindsay McCarthy and the whole staff of the Eugene Symphony, and of course to our studio audience and listeners. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen. Friends and Neighbors with Kobe Lucas is next.